From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For a war that ended 40 years ago, there's been a lot in the news lately about Vietnam. The anti-war activists who broke into the FBI in 1971 have just revealed themselves. There are books about going to Vietnam and books about refusing to go. The choices we make in our youth vary from generation to generation, but each choice helps define who we become. 40 years ago, the choice I and thousands of others had to make was whether to go to Vietnam or refuse to go. I chose to become a conscientious objector. Deciding to apply for status as a CO had a long-lasting effect on me and those around me. It made me think about who I am and who I wanted to be, and about who went in my place. And now, as I get ready to retire as host of To the Best of Our Knowledge, I want to reassess some of those choices, mine and others. When Coleman's memoir, Spoke, crossed my desk, it seemed as though he wrote it to me. We were about the same age. We were confronted with many of the same choices. Coleman was friends with the anti-war activists Daniel and Philip Berrigan at Cornell in Ithaca, New York, and he went to prison for refusing to accept induction.
I was so uncomfortable with what was going on with the war and felt personal responsibility for it that I couldn't keep my mouth shut on it. So I returned my draft card very privately in a letter to my draft board rather than through a public demonstration. I had considered applying for a CO status, but I wrestled, and I'm still wrestling, with am I or am I not a conscientious objector by the pure definition of conscientious objector. I'd always thought that during World War II, I would have gladly fought against Hitler, for example. So that would disqualify me from any definition of conscientious objector. But the other problem was draft boards in the United States did not equally apply the rules of conscientious objection. In Oklahoma, no one had ever been granted conscientious objector status. It was the law, but it was not allowed. And so Quakers, Mennonites, and others who were genuine conscientious objectors who applied for it were routinely turned down and routinely given prison sentences in Oklahoma as well. So that really wasn't an option for me.
This is the point at which I think we have to go back and look at what brought you to this point. And I think it's pretty clear that the first and perhaps most influential person was your mother.
I had an amazing mother. I was very, very fortunate. She was, without a doubt, the most compassionate person I've ever known. And I've tried to model myself after that to the best that I can. But she had no inclination for activism of any kind, but things changed. She was in a terrible fire, and she found herself ostracized by her community, largely because of her looks. She was terribly scarred and handicapped.
The horrifying story is that she went back to her church looking for community.
Yes. After her first visit there, the minister asked my father not to bring her back because her looks were disturbing to the rest of the congregation. But she had, at the hospital, her caretakers were primarily black nurses, and they became her best friends. And one of them, a Mrs. Fulbright, invited my mother to go to her church on Oklahoma City's east side. And that's how my mother became involved in the Oklahoma NAACP and NAACP Youth Council in Oklahoma City and eventually started joining sit-ins and demonstrations to end segregation in Oklahoma City.
You have pictures of her as a chaperone for young black Americans taking a trip to Washington, D.C.
Well, on that bus, she met a man who wanted to move to our part of Oklahoma City. He had accepted a job as a doctor, and my mother offered to sell him our house. That just wasn't done. There were no blacks not only in our community, but within many, many, many miles of our community. And so a cabal of city leaders, including my father and the town mayor.
Your minister.
The same minister. And the sheriff got together to take care of the problem. And the solution was they arrested her, charged her with insanity. The charge was that she had been associated with black people. She'd had them in her home. She rode on a bus with them all the way across the U.S.
And this was a sign of insanity.
She was there for 5 years. Her medical record was 23 pages long. And it stated at the very beginning she was not there to be treated. She was there to be confined.
Well, I guess I think it's important because what we want to talk about is what led to you deciding it was a question of character, a question of conscience, to make a decision about the Vietnam War. And I can't help but believe that this had to have shaped your willingness to examine that question of conscience.
It definitely did. And then there were some triggers in 1967 and 68 that pushed me over the edge to compel me to do something. The summer of 67, I was asked to teach a short theater course to some kids that were brought to the campus of Cornell, where I was going to school, and they were brought there from Harlem. And in working with those kids, I realized that most of them, the boys anyway, were probably going to go to Vietnam. They weren't going to go to Cornell. They weren't going to get 2S deferments. And it deeply bothered me that I had something they couldn't have. That weighed on me. That December, I brought my mother on a 2-week furlough from the hospital to Cornell, just visiting with her and talking about what her life was like and what happened back then. And it made me ever more determined to do something for her. But again, I still had no idea what to do or how to do it.
It was also 1967, wasn't it, that you met the Berrigans for the first time?
Actually, that was 68. That January, I took a job at Cornell United Religious Work, and my office was directly across the hall from Daniel Berrigan's office. He was an intimidating man to me at first, and there's nothing intimidating about Daniel Berrigan. He's about the most approachable human you'll ever meet. But he was intimidating to me because of where I was, I think. I was ready to do something and not ready to do something. So that fall, I got to know him a little bit, but mostly I observed going in and out of his office of many, many visitors from all over the world. And then in April of that year, the weekend that Martin Luther King was assassinated, that's when I returned my draft card to my draft board, when I felt ultimately compelled I had to do it. And on the following Monday, I knocked on Dan's door and said, I need to talk with someone. And that's when we became friends.
What was the Selective Service response when you mailed them your draft card?
Oh, it was immediate. They immediately took away my student deferment and reclassified me something called 1A delinquent. The next decision was, would I refuse induction in upstate New York, where I had a good chance of having a very short sentence or no sentence at all, or would I go back to Oklahoma, where no one had defied the draft publicly, except for some very quiet, conscientious objectors that nobody knew about.
How did you make a decision?
If I was going to do this thing, I was going to try to make it count. I knew if I did it in Oklahoma, there might be an opportunity for me to get something started there.
So what happened when you got there?
I got noticed. I became the local cause celeb for the next 6 months or so, until my trial and my imprisonment for refusing induction.
At some point, you decided to go a little bit further. You and some friends decided to take action.
My first taste of imprisonment in Oklahoma, after my draft trial there, I was out on bond, and I went back to school at Cornell with my tail between my legs, because I was beat up pretty bad in Oklahoma, and my first taste of prison scared the death out of me. I hunkered down, and I was just a student for the better part of a year. But throughout that year, the war kept going on and kept getting worse, and thousands more young American men kept getting killed, and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese kept getting killed. And then it was when Dan Berrigan decided to go underground and not go to prison for his action in Catonsville that I was invited to assist with his going underground. And that's when I decided to amp up my game against the war because something more needed to be done.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the time you were in prison. There was something different about being in prison then because of who was also in prison, yes?
There was. When I was in the El Reno Federal Prison in Oklahoma during a brief period in 68, I met a young inmate there who was happy while I was just scared out of my wits. His name was Phil Schumann.
What was he there for?
He was there for a drug offense, selling drugs at University of Kansas in Lawrence. He was clearly very, very happy. And it drove me nuts trying to figure out what was wrong with him, that he didn't realize that he was in prison. Well, later on, I had a chance outside of prison to get to know Phil. And he taught me what his secret was, basically two things. That life is life. He said everybody's in some kind of a prison of their own making or a prison of steel bars, or happiness is what you make it. You're in charge of your own happiness. The other thing he told me is never be alone in prison. And I'd noticed that Phil was never alone. Wherever he was always surrounded by a group of people of his own choosing who were keeping him company and keeping him safe. When I finally went to do my time, that's what I looked for. And it was there very, very quickly, in large part because there were a lot of COs, conscientious objectors, in prison.
So I have to ask, it's 50 years almost since you got out of prison. I still have nagging wonder what all I thought I was doing.
Well, how could you not? They were extraordinarily confusing and difficult times. And we were 20 years old. I was tormented by what I was doing, all the while I was doing it. I think that's something that conscience does. Daniel Berrigan, when I first met him, he intimidated me, not because he's an intimidating person, he's not, but because what he represented to me.
He was a man of conscience.
Yeah, and that's troubling because that challenges anyone else to look at their own conscience and what they might need to be doing too.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coleman. He goes by one name, is the author of Spoke, A Mother, A Son, Civil Rights, Vietnam.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
My college career pretty much sums up the changes of the late 60s. There was a panty raid in the dorms when I was a freshman. By the summer of my senior year, the so-called New Year's Gang had planted a bomb on the University of Wisconsin campus, killing Robert Fasnacht, a promising young researcher who was working late that night. By the time that explosion occurred, I'd joined protest marches, I'd thought long and hard about service, and I had applied for status as a conscientious objector. When I got my CO status, I did my required alternative service working as a psychiatric aide. Searching for answers about that time, I turned to two friends, Robert Cardineau and Mark Peterson. They were both COs who worked with me at the Yale Psychiatric Institute. And we sat down to talk about the war, about the draft, and about what it meant to choose to refuse. And, as Robert says, about the lottery.
My number was 76, so I didn't have long.
I was 74, same thing.
Oh, really? Wow.
Everybody knew what their friends' numbers were and what your status was and what was going to happen to you.
Yeah. Do you remember listening to that? I listened to it on the radio. They gave one birth date after another. It was so weird. Birth date after birth date after birth date came up, and all of a sudden, you know, each one you'd say, not me. But I still think, maybe I'm just saying this from a distance, but that wasn't what made me decide to apply to be a CO.
Well, I was slowly forced into a corner. First, I had a college deferment. Then I had another years of a college deferment because I got my master's in teaching at Oberlin. And then suddenly I was out of deferments. Then I tried to get a medical deferment because I did have a ruined foot from a motorcycle accident.
But you had a beautiful gait.
Right, that's what the doctor said. He told me I had a beautiful gait and I was fine. So then I actually did get my 1A. It was then that I decided, well, there's just no way I'm going.
Yeah. I remember going through a long period of disillusionment with the idea of the war in Vietnam. The idea of actually committing some violent act, just kind of out of the question.
I remember talking to all sorts of people. Some of them, you know, they ate too much, so they were too heavy for the army to take them. And I still remember one guy who lost so much weight, his pants fell off.
Everybody had their plot.
Yeah.
The conscience part, I've always felt like a slightly off base. You know, part of the common sense idea of conscience is that the conscience is telling you to do something for the greater good that runs against self-interest. And I never felt like being a conscientious objector ran against my own self-interest in any way.
I thought I was protecting something, actually.
Yes.
It was standing up for a line which I just felt I couldn't cross, period.
So I'm curious how you, it was a personal decision for each of you, was for me anyway, a personal decision, but I remember talking it over with friends. I remember going to the American Friends Service Committee and reading about others who'd applied for COs.
Well, my grandmother was a Quaker, and she probably would have patted me on the back. But I didn't discuss it with her, and my parents were overseas.
So you were really on your own.
So I was completely on my own and completely free.
I had long exchanges with my parents. My mom didn't say much. I think she was sort of in support. But my dad wrote me letters about how I had an obligation to the country, and it makes me laugh now, how some discipline would be good for me.
Wow.
Well, we know that's true.
That I just, for the first time in 40 years, I looked through the files I've kept from applying for this.
Oh, you're a braver man than I am.
I was astonished. I want to go back and hug all these people who wrote me letters.
Oh, isn't that nice? You know, I hadn't thought about the letters, Jim. That's very interesting. You have to make the statement about why you're a conscientious objector. And I wanted to be exact and truthful in the statement. I really wanted to not say anything that would sort of get me off the hook accidentally. That wasn't what I believed. And after I wrote it, I drove back from Indiana to Oberlin and to give it to my favorite philosophy professor to, like, certify. It wasn't so important that it was legally going to get me off, but I wanted to make sure that philosophically it was accurate.
It's like wanting to be real.
I share that completely, because I was under the either misapprehension or apprehension that you had to claim the status based on religious grounds, and because I had no religious affiliation at all, specifically said, I'm not doing this on religious grounds. I'm doing this on ethical grounds. And I felt that at least made me honest.
Right. I don't know. I just had this funny feeling thinking about this. We all thought it was an absolutely immoral act to go and do violence to people of Vietnam under these circumstances. And yet we didn't want to, like, lie about getting out of it.
Well, yeah, and it's somehow acknowledging your duty to the country somehow still to not falsify your stand. Did you have to appear before the board?
I did. I had to go.
What was that?
That's interesting. See,
you guys
I always
didn't?
Thought that was the model. No, I didn't even know where it was.
I did go there. I went. I turned in my application. I got a receipt saying we've received it. We'll consider it. I got a notice saying you have to show up for an interview. And I remember going to the interview and answering the questions. And they said, we'll get back to you. And I went home and sweated bullets and... So you didn't have to go. You didn't. You never saw the board?
Was never called.
No, neither was I.
Yeah.
So you just sent in the application and...
Yeah. And then I got some sort of a notice.
So you too, Mark, you just sent it in? And
I sent it in. Months passed.
Oh.
So I don't know how I know this, but when it met for me, I must have seen a record of some kind. Of the five members of the board, three showed up, two voted in my favor, and one against. And I got the card, and I was off.
what sort of fascinates me about looking back at all of this is the realization that we were put in a position where we had to think about this. And in some ways, that's a good thing. I don't think the draft was a good thing, but I think it may have been a good thing for me to have to decide I wasn't going to go.
Yeah. I think once the decision to say no, then you're forced to do a little more thinking, because you were taking a resistance route. And more than that, you had to write it all down and explain why and rationalize it. So,
if you were inclined to, I think the deal is that the vast majority of young men in our situation didn't have the tools, background.
Well, there's that, isn't there? I mean, there's
sit
this
and think about it and write the clever statements that we all wrote and do all of that. They assumed that when they got the call, that was it, and they're off. And we had a great privilege to be able to have a hand in the outcome in a certain way, but I don't think realistically the majority of folks in our situation did.
Yeah, we all went to Oberlin. We all applied for CO. We all went to YPI.
We're not a representative group, are we?
So when you gain CO status, you then are given the right to go do alternate service. It's 2 years long.
Well, right. So the
24
idea was,
months.
There were some rules about it had to be for a public service organization of some kind. Healthcare was always safe. And the Yale Psychiatric Institute. Primary mission was to treat adolescent schizophrenics.
It's part of the Yale New Haven Hospital, a teaching hospital.
Yeah, I was very grateful to have some useful work or be of some value to a bunch of people who were clearly in need of some kind of help. It was like way better than going to Vietnam in terms of both your benefit to the world and your benefit to yourself.
When I went back and looked at my CO, when I went back and looked at some of the stuff from YPI, I think, oh my God, this is when I became the person I am.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it's definitely a matter of identity.
You know, it was an abrupt detour in a way, and so it was a bit of like being together in an outpost. A lot of emotional content that we needed to share with each other that was coming up for the first time because we'd never seen folks in this kind of trouble.
Interestingly enough, thinking about it that way, I certainly don't have any regrets. I don't feel that I missed out on anything. And the fact that I had to do the alternate service probably did me some good, which ironically sounds like the statement that your dad made about a little discipline wouldn't hurt.
And I should add that
oddly enough,
I found in my file a letter from my dad to the board which said, I believe him. In many more words than that, he said, we don't agree, but I believe him. Robert Cardineau, Mark Peterson, and I all did alternative service as conscientious objectors during the Vietnam War. We worked together as aides at the Yale Psychiatric Institute in New Haven, Connecticut. If you have comments about this hour, bring them to our Facebook page or send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. talking about the choices young people made at the time of the Vietnam War and what those choices meant as the years passed. Bill Ayers was a member of the Weather Underground, which set off a series of bombs around the country in protest against the Vietnam War. He's written a memoir, Fugitive Days, and in this conversation with Steve Paulson, Ayers begins by talking about being an activist.
I was first arrested opposing the war in 1965, and by 1968, when Lyndon Johnson resigned the presidency, and we had a massive march on the home of the president of the University of Michigan, where I was a student, and he came out and addressed the crowd, and he said, "Congratulations, you've won, and we've won, and now there will be peace." And we believed it, and yet the war went on, as you know, for 7 more years, and millions of lives had to be lost. And what we saw, what I saw, was a war of terror against the whole people. And every day that we didn't end the war, 2,000 or 3,000 more human beings would be wiped out. And so it became quite a despairing kind of moment, I think. But we were searching, trying to figure out how to raise the sharpest possible alarm against the war.
Tell me about the time when you did go underground. I mean, what you were trying to accomplish and some of the things that you did.
In 1970, the townhouse in Greenwich Village is blown up and 3 of my friends are killed, including my girlfriend, Diana Outen. And at that point, a group of us goes underground because we look forward and we see that people are being killed, that we are being beaten and harassed and arrested.
But just to be clear about that, explosion was presumably the people in that townhouse.
Absolutely.
Were the ones who accidentally
The 3 people who were killed were building bombs, that's right, and they set it off. And we always assumed that it was an accident. But we were then facing massive criminal charges. And our choice, it seemed to us at the time, was to spend the next several years defending ourselves in court, which we didn't trust and which we thought would be an entire waste of time, or to try to kind of survive on the run and continue to kind of protest the war using extreme and illegal means. And that's what we ended up doing.
And why did you choose to use those extreme means? I mean,
because we, you know, as I said, I mean, we began the opposition to the war in 1965. By 1968, Vietnam vets were returning, and they were saying, "This is an atrocity that we're committing over there. It's a war of terror against a people. It's not a legitimate war. It's not legal. It's not moral. It has to stop." So from 1968 to 70, we intensified our efforts to stop that war. And the war went on, and there was no end in sight. Richard Nixon won the presidency with a secret plan to end the war. The secret plan turned out to be to escalate the war. And so a group of us decided that we were going to, you know, sound an alarm that was more intense and more urgent than any that had been sounded before. You know, in many ways, and I don't know how you read the book, but in many ways I read the book as a meditation on terrorism and a rejection of terrorism, both terrorism by individuals and by groups, but also official terrorism.
It's fascinating to hear you say that this is a meditation against terrorism. Of course, the charge has been leveled at you that you're a terrorist.
No, we weren't terrorists. Terrorism is the targeting of people, the targeting of innocents. What we saw September 11th was, of course, a huge and clear example of a crime against humanity, of terrorism. But what we witnessed 30 years ago was government policy that said, here, let me draw a circle around large swaths of this country. Anyone living there can be killed and murdered. I actually have one chapter in which I actually describe 2 groups of young people, both of them despairing, both of them a little bit off the track, one terribly frightened and one terribly determined. One group of young people fashions a 3-pound bomb to slip into the Pentagon to go off in the middle of the night as a symbolic act against the killing. No one was killed. No one was injured. In fact, no one was ever killed or injured in the actions that we did. And the second group of young people marches into a Vietnamese village, kills 347 people over a 6-hour period, rapes, loots, burns, and I raise the question, which is terrorism? Both are violent. Both are illegal. But which is terrorism?
What were you trying to accomplish strategically by setting off these explosions?
We were trying, I think, to say to the government, and to the American people. This war has created such a crisis that it's coming home. And as I say, we never intended to kill anybody, and we never did kill anybody. So I see that, and I don't know why other people don't, but I see that as a huge moral distinction.
So you don't have regrets?
I would say that, you know, I regret anybody's feelings who were hurt. I regret anybody that I harmed. Sure, I'm sorry about a lot of things, but if I look at that progression of activity against the war, I actually think we were tremendously restrained. Had somebody been hurt or killed, that would be indefensible. I think what happened here at Madison, the killing of that researcher, was indefensible.
Well, let me follow up on that, because that happened less than a mile from where we're sitting right now. The Army Math Research Center at the University of Wisconsin was blown up. The bomb was set off in the middle of the night. The intention was not to kill anyone. That's why they did it then. Unfortunately, tragically, someone was in the building then. They didn't know that. A researcher was killed. One of the bombers, Carl Armstrong, has since come out and expressed great public regret, remorse.
As I think he should.
But couldn't that easily have happened with you? I mean, weren't you just lucky that no one was killed in any of these
explosions? I think we were lucky, but I also think we were thoughtful and restrained. As I say, I think that the restraint is something worth noting. So I think it's absolutely marvelous that Carl Armstrong expresses remorse, expresses regret, because one person was killed and that's a whole universe that was destroyed. And so I don't have any doubt that if I had been involved in that, I would be expressing deep, deep remorse. But what I don't get is why the Carl Armstrongs are always called to task, because what they did was extreme, without a doubt, but not as extreme as what was done every day in our name. In the 3 years or 4 years that we're talking about, there were something like 20,000 bombings and arson incidents in the United States against war-related targets. And as far as I know, one person was killed. That's restraint, in my view. And as far as I know, every day that the war in Vietnam went on, 2,000 people were killed.
Let me mention another reaction to your book, the review that was in The Nation by John Leonard. And I want to quote here. He says, "Don't tell me that you had to be there to feel Weather's rage. We were there, and most of us thought that they were bonkers, renegade splinters of the fractured new left, imagining themselves to be samurai or Sioux, boxers or Bolsheviks, turned violent." What do you make of that kind of criticism?
I think I said something similar in the book, actually. I think I said something about the extent to which we kind of had a metaphor of ourselves that was super inflated and way beyond what we were capable of. So I don't feel that the book in any way defends our self-righteousness, defends the errors that we made in terms of turning away from the mass movement. But I think it's very easy now to kind of stand on the high ground of middle age and throw rocks into the valley of youth. And did we splinter and factionalize and fracture? We did. And we are partly responsible for that. But again, it's easy to kind of look back and say, oh, I would have done it this way. Well, how did he do it? I mean, what was the right answer? I don't think anybody knows for sure.
Bill Ayers is the author of Fugitive Days, a memoir about his time with the Weather Underground. His most recent book is Public Enemy.
I got a letter from LBJ. It said, "This is your lucky day. Time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it might seem very queer, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese."
Carl Marlantis chose to take part in the Vietnam War. He's a decorated Marine. He received the Navy Cross, the Bronze Star, and two Purple Hearts. At the age of 23, he was put in charge of the lives of 40 other young men. He was not psychologically or spiritually prepared for that or for what came after the war. Marlantis writes about his experience in his book, What It Is Like to Go to War.
It was about 2 days before Christmas, and I had been on top of a very tall mountain and had been left there with just a platoon to cover a whole company's front. And we were exhausted, and we were trying to do the work of a company, pretending to be a company, and we'd gotten hit a couple of times, and I'd lost three people to a terrible friendly fire incident. And this was the first time I was actually in command all by myself of a fire base and the platoon, because the company had left. So this was really my sort of first initiation into combat. And it was just before Christmas. And so I thought I'd read you a bit about what happened on that day. 2 days before Christmas, the fog lifted just enough to allow a single chopper to work its way up to us, a dangerous journey, squeezing beneath the cloud ceiling just a few feet above the jungle-covered ridges. Along with food, water, mail, and ammunition came the battalion chaplain. He had brought with him several bottles of Southern Comfort and some new dirty jokes. I accepted the Southern Comfort, thanked him, laughed at the jokes, and had a drink with him. Merry Christmas. Inside, I was seething. I thought I'd gone a little nuts. How could I be angry with a guy who had just put his life at risk to cheer me up? And didn't the Southern Comfort feel good on that rain-raked mountaintop? Years later, I understood. I was engaged in killing and maybe being killed. I felt responsible for the lives and deaths of my companions. I was struggling with a situation approaching the sacred in its terror and contact with the infinite, and he was trying to numb me to it. I needed help with the existential terror of my own death and responsibility for the death of others, enemies and friends, not Southern Comfort. I needed a spiritual guide.
You know, what's compelling about that paragraph that you just read is what it leads to. Because of the suggestion that war is a spiritual experience and you need a spiritual guide.
Right. I know most people are aghast when I mention that thesis. But what is spiritual experience about? What are religions about other than death? If we didn't die, I don't think we would probably do much of that sort of activity. And here you are, you have a 19-year-old who has been raised in a basically Judeo-Christian culture, thou shalt not kill. And then suddenly they are transported, usually to some foreign country, and asked to kill for their country, which is totally the opposite of everything that they've ever done. When you kill another human being and you sort of wake up to the fact, which usually happens after you do it, you don't just have a wound to your body or your psyche from the war, you actually have a wound to your soul. And looking at warfare, because it does deal with death, and 19-year-olds cast in the role of the gods.
It seems to me that you're suggesting that our soldiers might be healthier if we not only talked about it, but had a more, well, for lack of another of a better word, a crueler introduction to what was going to be asked of them.
Yes, I wouldn't use the word cruel. I would use the word darker. The 19-year-old isn't going to, you know, be enlightened and go into combat sort of like our ideal of the samurai soldier or something. But if you can tell him ahead of time, you're going to experience this. This is going to happen to you after you come back. It may not happen the first week. It may happen a decade later. I dealt with PTSD for four decades. If someone had told me what was coming down the road, I would have probably recognized it 20 years earlier, saved a lot of problems.
Well, and what you're talking about is two periods in a soldier's life, the in-combat time and the post-war career time. The PTSD is something that everybody is aware of, but hardly anybody talks about.
Right.
Now.
Yeah. No, it's
And
it's
you think
brutal.
that training will both help you kill and help you survive the killing?
I don't think it'll help you kill. You don't want to take another human life. So the way that we sort of trick ourselves in combat is that we sort of get into the mental state that that person that you're about to kill is actually not a person. You know, words like gook, towelhead, ragtop, damn Yankee, you name them. And we have all these things in our culture that allows us to make the other person, non-human. Because if it was human, you would hesitate and it would be much harder. I had an experience where this broke down and that haunted me some 20 years after the war.
You talk about this in the book.
I do.
You can still remember looking into the eyes,
eyes of a
man who was as scared as you were.
Exactly. And we happened to just be no more than about 10 or 15 feet apart. And he had been throwing grenades at me and my friends and had wounded badly one of my friends. And we were throwing them back and had killed one of his friends who was in the hole. And I had snuck up on the side so I could get a shot at him to stop this. And I was looking at him right across the barrel of the M16. And he stood up with the hand grenade already ready to pull the primer. And we locked eyes. And I was whispering out loud, I wish I could speak Vietnamese. Don't throw it. If you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger. Don't throw it. If you don't pull it, I won't pull the trigger. I did not want to do that. He just snarled at me and threw it. And I pulled the trigger. 20 years later, I'm driving down I-5, you know, 2 a.m, country music on the radio, a nice little bubble of warmth in the car. And those two eyes appeared in the windshield. And it was my unconscious saying, Marlanus, you got to deal with this. And that was a large impetus for writing this book.
Well, and this is the thing when you come home, when you stop being a soldier, all that time when you took the emotion out of it in order to do your job,
mm-hmm.
It sounds as though that comes roaring back, almost as though you have to experience all of that emotion that you kept out.
Yeah, I don't know if you have to. I did. I mean, writing this book, I mean, I'd have snot on the keyboard from bawling my eyes out because of trying to sort of, I mean, it would come roaring out. And I suspect that that is the way it works. You can't get the job done if you're completely in the throes of an emotional state. But on the other hand, you still are a human being and you have experienced this. And in order to integrate it, you do have to start to feel it. So that's why it's important, again, that you tell the young soldier that you're going to feel this, but that's good. Not, oh, you're terrible. You're breaking down. And we have a lot of that problem. I mean, guys are afraid to go in and get help for PTSD because if it says unstable on their record, they're not going to get a promotion. So, I mean, it's very hard.
Can you train soldiers ahead of time to know? You talk about needing a spiritual guide.
Yeah.
That's where we started this conversation.
Sure. I think there are simple things that you can do that will help you retain your humanity and your connection to the spirit. For example, if you could just train corpsmen, who are sort of the big brothers. I mean, they're usually older than the others. And you give them just a little training of how do you handle the grief of losing a friend? How do you bury the enemy? We used to throw them off the sides of the hill. And I had this one moment where two guys in my platoon had, we'd been under attack for days, and he'd lost a lot of friends. And the dead were just down right below our fighting holes. And they had gone down and cut the ears off. Okay, they're like 18, 19 years old. It's like Letterman sweater stuff. And I had been in combat in country a long time, and I wasn't angry with them, but I knew you couldn't let that go. And so I just said, look, I know they killed your friends. You killed their friends, and you killed them. And I said, this is nothing that you should get trophies over. And so I said, I want them buried. And that wasn't trivial because we were still taking sniper fire. And they went down, dug that hole, and they both started crying. That, I'm sure, moved them forward to being able to reintegrate back into normal society because they touched what their humanity was on the spot. They didn't make them any less effective Marines. Believe me, I know those two guys. That night we were hit again, they were doing just the same job that they would have before.
But maybe because they had their grief then.
Exactly.
They didn't have to have it 5 years later.
Or 20 years later. They didn't have to be even afraid to let it come out.
Carl Marlantis is the author of What It Is Like to Go to War and of the novel Matterhorn. If you have thoughts about this hour you'd like to share, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or share them on our Facebook page. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Tim O'Brien went to Vietnam as a young man. He returned to write some of the best fiction around about the experience. His book, The Things They Carried, is considered a classic Vietnam collection. Some years later, he wrote a novel called July, July, looking back at those days, and he came in to talk with me about the lifelong consequences of the decisions the Vietnam generation made, and about the difference between dissent then and dissent now.
Vietnam will always cast a shadow over my work, I'm sure. But I'm writing about it less directly now and probably more obliquely.
Thinking about all the characters in July, July, it's as though Vietnam is an extra one in the end because it affects everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's the story of a class reunion. These people graduated in 1969, so it's natural that Vietnam would play a role in their lives to a greater or lesser extent.
Do you think that there is something about that generation? This book suggests that there was a greater awareness of good and evil, maybe, in 1969 than there is 30 years later.
It seems to me that what you just said is pretty accurate, that as a personal matter, my skin was alive in a way, and my corpuscles of my body were alive and attuned to the good and evil in this world. I feel now a kind of bandwagon effect in this country of patriotic, let's go get 'em fervor that wasn't quite so universal back in 1969. There are more debates were raging, for one thing. The debates now seem very muted to the point where I haven't really heard one. There's a kind of bowing to the inevitability of violence and war that I didn't feel that bowing back in 1969.
What's happened, do you think? Are we really a different country now?
I think there's a kind of terror to speak one's mind. I think people are afraid to say, I mean, I'm afraid to speak my mind. I'm afraid to say things like, boy, we sure tend as a country to demonize our enemies. First it's Tojo, and he's a Satan, and Hitler is a Satan, and Geronimo was a Satan, and Crazy Horse is a Satan, and Ho Chi Minh was a Satan, and Bin Laden's a Satan. They're all Satans, every one of them, without exception. And that's a big mistake, to devalue opposition to American policy. I find it disgusting, but I'm afraid to say these things. It's a little bit reminiscent of my time back in the Vietnam War, where this sense of violence is the quick and easy solution to everything that it frightens me.
You know, 30 years ago, those things were more easily talked about. So it was a different time, a different country.
Mm-hmm.
You could protest then and people would pay attention, and you can protest now and nobody will.
Mm-hmm.
Something's happened. But the same people are alive now that mm-hmm. were then, the same generation. The people in your book are still here. They're just 30 years older.
Mm-hmm. Life is a way of whittling you down, I think. I don't know. It seems to me as if people of my generation care about tending their own backyards and making sure things are in shape in their lives and in their relationships, and their scope of vision has narrowed a bit. Because it is hard to tend your own backyard, to keep relationships together and take care
of
children. It's a lot of work, and it's time-consuming, and it's important work. The unfortunate consequence of that may be that less attention is paid to global geopolitics.
Well, I look back. I was a conscientious objector in 1969 and did not go to Vietnam, and I'm not out on the barricades today.
Well, you know, the difference, I mean, that's what the characters in the book face, are these moments of, I don't know, a decision. When you decide to file for, you know, CO status or to go on a plane to Vietnam, you're making an over-the-cliff choice that is going to follow you for the rest of your life in various ways. It's going to be in your, and I don't mean issues of guilt or pride, I mean simply issues of defining who you are for the rest of your life. And I think the same is true of the characters in this book. Sure, they've changed. They have lost a little bit of the zip and the passion of political idealism. But at the same time, there's something about the maturing process that's not all bad. It's not bad to pay attention to issues of love and personal relationships. It's not bad to pay attention to a sense of lifelong loss, as some of the characters have. the past is part of the present, and July is partly about that. What the title means, July then and July now, they're in some ways identical.
Could that time ever come again for another generation?
Oh, sure. I'm sure it could. I wouldn't exclude anything. Anything's possible in this world. I've lived long enough to know. Some of the things in the late 1960s, I'm not sure I want to see return. I'm not sure I want to see the Kent State happen again. I'm not sure I want to see a hard hats colliding with young people in New York City and people being beaten up. Some of that stuff I don't want to see again. I do want to see civilized discourse. I want to see people finding the courage to talk about, you know, their values and their beliefs. But not all of the 90s. It's easy to, looking back on the 1960s, to get a bit nostalgic and sentimental. And I think that's a mistake. I've never been to a college reunion like the characters in this book, and maybe I never will go. Yet in my heart, I'm kind of both places at once now. I'm back in 1969 in my head, you know, standing in peace vigils. I'm also back in 1969 getting on an airplane to Vietnam. And then I'm the man I am today, a writer. I'm both. I'm sort of young now in my heart, but I'm also carrying the burdens of, you know, late middle age. That's our generation.
Tim O'Brien is the author of The Things They Carried, July, July, and many other books. He won the National Book Award in 1979 for his novel Going After Cacciato. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for A Matter of Conscience. This hour is a little more personal than most. That's because it's one of the last that I will do before I retire. If you have questions or comments about the program, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. Or join us on our Facebook page for further discussion. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. I produced this hour with Sarah Nix. As always, I enjoyed the help of Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.